am a Jamesian as it comes to religion, which is not so popular if you do cognitive science of religion, because William James thought there was really a sort of sui generis quality, a quality of religious experience that can't be easily reduced to other things.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 4 of Damn the Absolute. We want to be in proper relationship with the world. In other words, we want to hold as many true beliefs as possible, or at least fewer false beliefs. We hope the ideas we hold will suit us well for adapting to the social, moral, and physical environments we find ourselves in. This is also true when it comes to religious beliefs, but how do we discern which ones are justified true beliefs and which ones are wrong-headed? The numberless instances of religious disagreement should cause each of us to seriously doubt and question our own religious truth claims and cause us to exercise caution when interpreting our personal religious experiences. When it comes to settling religious disagreements, how do we determine who qualifies as an epistemic peer? What is an epistemic peer, and how seriously ought we to take the religious views of other people? Helen DeCruz holds the Danforth Chair in the Humanities at St. Louis University. Her research is concerned with the questions of why and how humans can deal with abstract, difficult concepts such as God and mathematical objects. She also explores how we can engage in creative endeavors such as philosophy and art. She is working on the question of how philosophy can help in discussions in the public sphere, including her recent monograph, Religious Disagreement. She has received grants from the British Academy, the American Philosophical Association, and most recently, the John Templeton Foundation for a study on the origins of human-specific morality. Now, religious experts are supposed to have privileged knowledge about religion. Yet, philosophers, including philosophers of religion, tend to hold a variety of views that mirror those of the general population. If that's the case, are they really that expert? Furthermore, what do we do about religious disagreement among lay people? What are we to make of the perceived knowledge gap between novices and experts? And how can we benefit by taking the conveyed religious experiences and beliefs of other people more seriously? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Well, Helen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on here. I'd like to start out with a question that is a damn the absolute tradition, and that is, what is a viewpoint you've held as an adult that you were certain wouldn't change that has actually shifted dramatically for you?
So you mean to say a viewpoint I've held since adulthood, I felt really confident about, and that I didn't think would change. So I don't know, like really far out, like I used to be a mathematical nominalist and now I'm a mathematical Platonist. So that means I used to think that mathematics was basically just a tool that you use, that humans use to describe the world. And basically it's a bit like, you know, like a language, like there's no objective reality. If everybody dropped dead right now, then mathematics would disappear, according to nominalists. But Platonists say that there is something more to reality and there's different ways in which you can cash that out. But basically the Platonism I'm really interested in is this idea that there are deep mathematical structures in reality, that we have access to those structures in all sorts of... And this is the most difficult thing, like, because if they are acausal, if they are not, like, for instance... How do I know that there is a cupboard over there? Well, there is a physical cupboard in my eyes, you know, the light falls on my retina. But with mathematical structures, they aren't directly instantiated in that way. Like you don't see an actual prime number or a circle or whatever. So the way they're instantiated is in structures, and that's how we recognize them. So prior to, say, 2014, I didn't think that this was the case, but I started changing my mind reading some Platonist works. And I even wrote a paper defending a form of Platonism. So that's like, so off the top of my head, that is a big change.
What's the name of that paper that you wrote about this?
Mathematical Realism is in the name of the paper. It was published in Philosopher's Imprint in 2016. Something about cognition, mathematical cognition. Like, so the puzzle to solve is how do we learn about these structures? And the interesting thing is that you have a wide variety of non-human animals who can detect things like geometric shape and numerosity. And anyway, that's the paper.
I just want to make sure it's available to our audience who
it's open
can look
access.
At it in the show notes. So.
Yeah, yeah.
In case they're looking for a big shift in their view on mathematics. So let's jump in here. We're going to be talking about religious disagreement. And to disappoint the listeners, we are not going to solve the big religious questions of the existence of God per se. What we're really looking at is what we can learn from religious disagreement. And to set that up, Helen, I'd love to hear a little bit more. What is your own personal religious background and how has that informed your research interest in religion and religious disagreement?
I grew up in a very homogeneously Catholic country, which is Belgium. Like, mm-hmm. It's not Catholic in the way that you Americans are Catholic. Like, you do everything so extreme. And you also do your Catholicism more extreme. Like, mm-hmm. even though, you know, I currently work at a Catholic institution, namely St. Louis University. And I don't think it's that extreme, but it can be. So I'd say about 80, 90% of the Belgian population is at least nominally Catholic. And my parents mm-hmm. are Catholics. My father has a peculiar form of Catholicism because he was born in Malaysia and he came mm-hmm. to Belgium in his 20s. And so Malaysian Catholicism is also very peculiar. Like, you have little altars with pictures of the Pope and that sort mm-hmm. of thing. So I grew up basically sort of thinking like, that's basically just this one religious thing. But then, you know, as a teenager, I started realizing that lots of people didn't at all think this plausible. Like, so I went to Catholic school and you had to go like to confession once a year and they had the mm-hmm. monthly mass. And then I had lots of schoolmates who said, oh, this is just rubbish. And, you know, they didn't feel at all like doing this. And that's when I realized this isn't sort of like the default thing. Like, what is the default thing? So that was like my first worry about what's the default state? What is the view that requires no justification, like as a background view? And it's not Catholicism, clearly. So what is it? So that's how I started seeing more and more like different religious views. My father already was cognizant of that because Malaysia is very ethnically and religiously diverse. And so mm-hmm. he was always going on about, you know, so many Muslims that were living when he grew up in the area where he grew up. So that I think piqued my sort of early interest. When I was an undergraduate, I don't know how long you particularly want this, but like, this is like everybody's story is very complex in mm-hmm. when they come to religion. Like, no matter what you end up with, your story is going to be very complex. So as an undergraduate, my first course in philosophy was done by this guy who used to be a Jesuit, but then he deconverted to sort of really kind of Dawkins-style naturalism. Mm-hmm. And he would like, he was such a sage on the stage professor. And he would stand there without any lecture notes in a huge audience. Like, there were like 400 or 500 freshmen in there. And he would just sort of start to say, like, here's why what everything in the Bible is completely bunk. And he would just sort of stare it down. And then, like, here's why religious people are irrational. And, you know, so mm-hmm. lots of the classes were like that. And then I thought, yeah, actually, the default is what I thought at that point. It's just atheism, right? I mean, it's the absence mm-hmm. of religious belief. And you need special justification. And I felt as an undergrad that I couldn't provide that. It's such a thick concept. Like, and also, why that particular religious belief and not just any other religious belief. And so that's the point at which I just thought, like, maybe I should be a naturalistic atheist. And I started reading Dawkins and, you know, already read him a bit when I was a teenager. And, you know, that was before Dawkins became sort of weird, misogynistic and anti-Muslim. Like, you know, mm-hmm. when Dawkins was just this cool guy that you could read and find really interesting. I found that very attractive. This sort of idea that we are lumbering survival machines, right? And that we have all these sort of base selfish instincts and mm-hmm. that you overcome those instincts and you can become more than just your biological background. So this is an aspect of Dawkins, I think, that people don't often recognize, that there is this very deep spiritual side of him. It just didn't work for me. I think that my brain is just not meant to have a purely naturalistic view. I know that sounds really teleological, but
I'm wondering, so you mentioned here on it at some point it not working for you. Was that in the sense of sort of sitting in your seat and processing arguments and the logic of it, or is it not working for you in a more lived practical sense?
I think definitely in a more lived practical sense, it didn't mm-hmm. work for me to be a naturalistic atheist. And that's not because people would say, you know, some people would say, look, religious people are just people who need some comfort, like they need something to feel good and to say, oh, it's not a problem. If I drop dead now, or if, God forbid, a loved one drops dead, then I'll see them in the afterlife. It's a comforting thought. But in fact, I think that people overestimate how much comfort religion brings. So it's not in that respect. I think if anything, I don't know, I find it sometimes an unsettling idea that there is, you know, like, is it more or less unsettling whether there is something or nothing? But at any rate, it just didn't, the sort of hard naturalism just didn't work for me, because I do see purpose in things. I can't not see purpose. And there's actually good psychological evidence about why people see purpose in things. So there are psychological researchers like Deborah Kahleman who found that even young children easily discern purpose in the world. And, you know, there's other researchers like Jesse Bearing and Bethany Haywood who found that even atheists, you ask them a question like, why did you fail your first year undergraduate? And they say things like, because I was meant to do something else. So it's very clear that there's something incoherent about that. If you're a sort of a hard naturalist, you'd just say, well, that's what happened. Or here is a causal explanation for why I failed. I partied too much. You wouldn't say, I was meant to do something else. So there is a sort of way in which this sort of teleological thinking fits better with a theistic view, I think. So, I think that in general, it's just a sort of worldview coherence. You have all sorts of ways in which you stand in the world, and there's always going to be some tension in how you deal with things. Like, everybody has these worldview tensions. But I think that with theism, I have fewer worldview tensions than with atheism.
So in addition to some of things falling a bit more into place as you're talking about, I'm wondering in regards to religious experiences, and I know religious experiences are very difficult for anyone to convey, and I know that from my own side versus somebody else, but I'm wondering, are there any specific religious accounts from people or acquaintances that also informed your changing view on some of these questions of naturalism or more theistic viewpoints?
Yeah, the question of religious experience is very interesting, and I think that in philosophy of religion, it's very hard to give it proper weight, because it sort of quickly devolves into this sort of thing about you have a religious experience, and on the face of it, it seems like we should trust our faculties. Theism gives reason to trust our faculties, and therefore we should trust religious experience. And if we do, well, then, so you see this sort of argument, right? So about religious, I'm a Jamesian as it comes to religion, which is not so popular if you do cognitive science of religion, because William James thought there was really a sort of sui generis quality, a quality of religious experience that can't be easily reduced to other things, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I think maybe James is wrong about that, and we can reduce religious experience to other things. For example, suppose that I feel God's presence, then it could just be my general sort of sense of detecting the presence of other agents. This is sort of a common theme in cognitive science of religion. But I think next to that James is absolutely right that the ultimate grounds of religion is, I think, experience. So there's just no, like, you could say maybe it's testimony, but then even so, that testimony still bottoms out in experiences. And if we didn't have those experiences, and everybody, you know, also the most hardened atheist has sort of experiences of the numinous, of the unusual, the sorts of experiences you have when you're in nature or just in any sort of situation. And I have those experiences very easily. So I found, for instance, with the whole social distancing and lockdown, I found it very interesting because I often have those experiences just sitting and looking at people. And, you know, you sort of get this sense of, I don't know, it's hard to describe, like you zoom out and you see like a bigger picture of all those people walking about. And then you think about all their lives and their past, etc. And then it sort of zooms out even more, as it's really hard to describe. But now with the whole social distancing, I don't quite have that anymore. I can't sit among people and people watch. And that is really spiritually more stultifying to me than not being able to attend in-person church, which is really, really strange. And I think that this sort of experience, but it could be different experiences for different people, really do give a sort of ground for religion that is underappreciated, even in philosophers who do talk about religious experience.
What thought process goes through your head? For example, if I'm an acquaintance of yours and I choose to divulge or share a religious experience that I've had, as you're trying to gauge the veracity of my religious experience and the claims I'm making about it, what thought process are you having as you're trying to evaluate that as compared to maybe other people who have different viewpoints on their religious experiences?
So I take usually what people say at face value. So that makes me super gullible. Maybe I shouldn't say this on air, but I am just somebody who just takes when somebody says something to me, I tend to take it at face value. So suppose that you relate to me extraordinary religious experience. I have no difficulty believing that because I've had like a couple of times really strong religious experiences that really are like the sort of James Rudolph Otto like variety. They're rare, but you know, you have them. And so I have no reason to doubt. Now, suppose that you said saw something that doesn't fit the sort of thing. Like suppose you saw Krishna playing his flute. Right. Mm-hmm. Even that, I think, you know, you did see that. So I, again, like you can't be wrong that you saw it. I mean, that you felt that you saw it, that you had that particular state of mind. I think it's very hard for us to interpret these sorts of experiences. So this is the internal debate between perennialism about religious experience and then sort of more culturally. And you know, most people like Anne Taves, for example, she has this sort of, so she's a religious studies scholar and they have a sort of hybrid approach. Like there are some perennial features to religious experiences, but there's also lots of cultural background. And we know that this is true because, you know, you can talk to people from many different cultures and unsurprisingly, you know, for instance, when Hindus have near-death experiences, they will see Shiva or Vishnu. When Christians have near-death experiences, they don't. So this is, in a sense, not surprising. I think it's just very hard for us to interpret religious experience. You know, we have cultural frameworks for that, but I don't think that they put me in a position to evaluate other people's religious experiences. The best I can say is I take it face value what you've experienced, and that is as far as it goes for me.
What you're describing, I believe, is what you've referred to as higher order evidence in religious disagreement, where you really rely on taking it at face value of, I believe you in a way. Part of that requires, you talked about having that other person be an epistemic peer. Could you tell me a little bit more of what you mean by an epistemic peer?
So an epistemic peer is a concept in epistemology that has recently enjoyed a lot of attention, and philosophers do not agree on what it is. But roughly, it is this. An epistemic peer is somebody that you judge has about the same, is in the same or in a similar situation with regard to the evidence as you are. So, for example, some epistemologists say an epistemic peer is somebody equally likely to get it wrong or right as you are. Now, I think with religion, you can't really say that. Or you have an epistemic peer is somebody who is just as thoughtful as you are, just as has all sorts of virtues in assessing the evidence. I think maybe there you do get to that, but then you have the problem all of a sudden that theologians are all our epistemic superiors with regard to religion. And I feel like, no disrespect to theologians, but I don't think I can be right. I think that there are certain features of religion that are so much part of our lived experience that it gets really hard to entangle what counts as, you know, being thoughtful about something, what counts as evidence. So I take it just in a sort of loose sense of an epistemic peer is just somebody you regard and you think, well, yes, this person, I respect what they're saying. I think that if I had been in that situation, very hard to say, I might have reached the same conclusion, but they don't. They have a different conclusion. And then you have to wonder, what do I do with that? Do I just ignore that and say, okay, she believes that, I believe this, let's both agree to disagree. And that's that. So that's like the steadfast position. The steadfast position is that no matter how many people I encounter who have different religious beliefs, I don't need to take it into account. But then you have the conciliationist idea. And that basically says, very generally speaking, that you should take into account other people's beliefs that you regard as epistemic peers. And I think even epistemic inferiors and superiors, you should take it into account as having some impact on your beliefs. Doesn't mean you have to give it equal weight. So some philosophers say you just have to give the same weight to what somebody else thinks, to what your conclusion you arrived at. And I just find that implausible. But some philosophers think that equal weight view. I just think that you need to give it some weight. So it does matter. Like when I was a child growing up among all these Catholics, and that's the only thing I knew, versus now I see all these people with different religious beliefs, it makes a difference. I'm in a different epistemic situation than had I continued in a sort of all Catholic milieu.
I'm wondering, one challenge is I think of the higher order evidence, where you have a different case where if I'm talking with two different people who, as you mentioned, near the end of their life, they use the religious imagery and concepts that are familiar to them that may be different, such as in a Hindu tradition versus a Catholic tradition. And they may talk about the comfort of the religious experience. And I think for most people, there's a lot of a leeway and acceptance of, yeah, I can hold both of these in my hand and be okay with it. But what do we do when we have two different people who, let's say, for example, they're both from a Catholic tradition and both say they had profound religious experience, and one took that experience to then informs my religious belief that abortion is wrong, and the other person has a religious experience that they then use to say, this informs me that having an abortion is an okay or a good thing. How is someone supposed to navigate that?
That's a great question. So I don't know, like people start saying this is a great question when they think like, how do I deal with this question? But like this question comes up a lot. So I actually, if you do philosophy of religion as I do, then you are in an interesting situation that lots of your epistemic peers are, in a sense, like there's lots of theists among philosophers of religion. But at the same time, there's huge disagreements. I think we are more politically diverse than any other philosophical specialization. There's so many conservatives, like there's even pro-Trumpers, and you have a whole range, and you have like ultra-liberal people as well. And you do see those things, like, what do you do with that? So my colleague, Alana Stump, was talking about this abortion issue, and she put it publicly on her Facebook page. So I think it's fine to say this.
Yeah,
that she said, look, with the abortion thing, like you can feel strongly one way or the other, but you know, how sure can you be? The path is very indirect. There's so many things, like there's no direct biblical, like there's no direct thing about abortion is wrong. You have to make a source bunch of inferences, like abortion is killing and killing is wrong. You know, it's clear that killing is not always wrong because biblical traditions have lots of sanctioned killings. Mm-hmm. So how do you make this link? You might say, look, I have this strong religious feeling that it's wrong, but you have lots of people who say, I feel very strongly that it's right. And I just don't see how you can use that feeling as a kind of epistemic tiebreaker. Like, okay, there's all these different arguments, but I have this strong feeling, and so I'm going with the feeling. I just don't see how these feelings can play that role. So I do think they play really a legitimate epistemic role. They play a role in how we deliberate, but it can't be as a sort of tiebreaker, as something that allows you to disregard a whole bunch of other evidence.
You were just talking about some of the political diversity, specifically in philosophy of religion and elsewhere, but I'm curious to know, you've, in your book, Religious Disagreement, you talk about the concern you have with echo chambers, with the increasing polarization and tribalization beliefs, and you talk about it being an epistemic crisis. How much does this worry you? And you can talk about that on like a United States level. I mean, feel free if you want to reach back toward Europe, but I'm curious how much you do worry about that, because this is definitely something that is talked about a lot online.
Yeah, definitely. So it's very interesting how online spaces help to entrench a lot of these differences and disagreements. But at the same time that, you know, we're trying to talk about it at this meta level. So there's a lot of online meta that level discussion going on. But I think particularly from a US context, but even a global context. So you have this gradual polarization about a lot of things that used to not be polarized that I think is very worrisome. It's very worrisome because you get a sort of almost Manichaean, because the stakes go up and up and up, because, you know, there's political differences. They have concrete policy and other implications. Suppose you differ about the coronavirus and what we should do. Maybe we should do nothing. So some people argue that. And that all has implications. Also doing lockdowns has implications. So all this has real world, very heavy effects. But the problem is that more and more what I'm seeing is that people see their interlocutors as the enemy, as the dark side. Like, you know, use any sort of, and there is this, it's just not helpful to do that. And I don't quite know how to get out of that, but it brings us in a very peculiar epistemic situation where you get more and more talking to people who are politically similar to you and similar to you in a variety of issues. And then things happen and you completely fall out of the sky and you think, what happened? How can all these people have such different ideas? But one of the reasons is that there hasn't been a constructive dialogue, a sort of, and we need that to tackle all sorts of problems. So we need to have a sustained, vigorous dialogue. You know, people talk a lot about elections, but, you know, as John Dewey and other people have already said, it's important to have just more discussions about policy between the elections, right? It's not that we're just sort of every 4 years people walk to the ballot box and or every 2 years. I don't know what the frequency is in the US. I think it's every 2 years. That's not going to do it by itself. So we have really practical implications of our beliefs. And that is why in the book I said that I think this is an epistemic crisis, a crisis on par of what happened in the 17th century when people started realizing that the medieval Christian consensus didn't work. So they were all, it started gradually sort of petering away. And already like in the 13th century, you have all this thing against Aristotelianism and that you had those discussions. And then by the time you have people in the 16th, 17th century, like Descartes and Locke, there they were. And they said, look, this beautiful edifice that has served us so well has completely collapsed. So what do we do now? And at least they had some idea of what they do. They had signs. Descartes had this sort of very ambitious project of just sort of sitting by yourself, thinking very deeply and figuring it all out and trying to sort of take your beliefs like one by one and say, does this belief work? Does this belief work? We can't do that. Like, we know now that this doesn't work. Our society is hyper-specialized. We have all this science that many of us, it's not that we, for instance, all overnight became epidemiologists and virologists. So how do we deal with that? We have no good framework of how to deal with testimonially transmitted knowledge, and particularly how to let that inform our debates in a way that is going to help us act better. So that's why I think it's a full-blown epistemic crisis.
The end there, you were touching on the knowledge gap between experts and lay people. And in a way, it seemed, going back to early modern philosophy at the time, some of the thinkers you mentioned, that when there's disagreement, some of that could more easily be resolved because people could refer to authority and say, well, here's the authority, so that's resolved. But now that we've had this democratization of so many things and fields as well, that now some of us probably feel more justified as experts in our knowledge or justified in our belief than maybe is actually justified. And it creates this knowledge gap. So I'm wondering, how do we address that knowledge gap where suddenly for some people, experts are no longer expert in their knowledge, or just anyone can have an opinion on something. And like you said, going back to COVID, where people are disagreeing with medical scientific experts on such fields and say, well, I know more. So how do we resolve that gap?
Yeah, I think that actually, the democratization of knowledge is not a bad thing. I think it's really important to empower people, but the problem is we didn't really empower people completely. So we empowered them by saying, look, your views matter. And even though it's controversial, I would still say your views matter. Even to, you know, the annoying guy on Twitter who comes from the University of Life. You know, if you see that in the tagline, like University of Life, then I think, oh my goodness, what's going to happen now? I think nevertheless, their views matter. And, you know, pragmatically, they do matter because they go to the ballot box and they vote and, you know, they help to inform policy. But I think that in order to truly empower people, you need to give them the tools to properly evaluate scientific expertise. And I feel like we are not doing a good enough job as educators to do that. I think a lot of that happens at university to some extent, like in our best moments, I'm hoping that we do that. But I think particularly at the high school level, and I don't know, like I'm not an educator, I don't know what would need to change. But it feels to me like there's still too much like teaching to test and not enough sort of like just helping people also just to wonder about something. So I feel like this is another thing we're losing, namely that is just the thing, like you don't have to form an opinion on everything. You know, on some things you can just look and be in a state of wonderment. Like, for example, about the whole lockdown situation and about, because that's a political decision in a sense. I mean, that it is empirically informed, like clearly it seems like lockdowns are working, but also they create huge problems for particularly for people who are already in difficulty, for vulnerable school children. So how do you deal with all that? And I just have no opinion on that. And I think that's totally fine. Like I'm not making policy and I don't need to have a set opinion on that. But it seems to me like we should empower people to be able to evaluate expert information better and also to be able to form opinions better. And that includes just also suspending judgment. So I think that there's just a sort of almost like a debate culture in everyday life that makes it very difficult to do that. But that would be empowering effect if people could get more, you know, if there were more of an atmosphere where they would be able to do that.
It seems with the rise of social, it's this tension in democratization where everyone has a megaphone that more and more of us feel like we have to have a position that we assert on every single thing, and that there's not enough people, like you were saying, who are saying it's okay to not know. You can admit that, and it's not a fault. It's actually a valorizing thing that you can acknowledge not knowing something. But that seems to be disappearing as we all have megaphones in our pockets now. So there's a few models that you bring up, Ellen. One is the expert as an authority model. Another is the expert as advisor model. And then there's one you put forward, which is the expert as teacher. Could you walk us through each of those and why you think the expert as teacher model helps to address some of the problems the other two models have?
The question at hand is how, as a novice, suppose that, take the COVID case, suppose that I don't know anything about epidemiology, and I didn't in fact become an overnight epidemiologist, even though I'm talking about the R-naught and about things like that. How do I know who to trust? So this question was originally put forward by Alvin Goldman. And, you know, he had all sorts of ideas about, like, you know, you can see like who's in the majority and, you know, how well did it sound like when they're defending themselves. But it still leaves a lot of questions unanswered. And so Linda Zagzabski has a really bold proposal. So she just says, you pick your expert, and that's where the problems start. You pick your expert, and then basically you just accept everything what the expert says as a guru. So the expert is, you know, if the expert says, say, cloth masks work, and you chose that expert, like cloth masks really reduce transmission, then, you know, you have no special epidemiological knowledge. So you take that on face value. And she has this really cool, you have experiments with rats that she talks about. Suppose that you can choose, you know, which you have to try to predict which light goes on. I forgot exactly how the experiment went. And you could try to do it by yourself, but you also know that, you know, most of the time it's going to be green. Well, your best bet is just to always do green. So similarly, if the expert, the epidemiologist that I follow, for example, if that person is more right than I am on a variety of subjects, why should I just follow them some of the time? I'll just follow them all of the time. And then I sort of get their amount of being right. Sort of I inherit that. But there is a big problem, because what if you pick the wrong expert? What if, you know, suppose you say, I just, you know, climate science, here is a climate scientist who says it isn't, in fact, anthropogenic. And I follow this person and it turns out it really is. Then I have just, you know, I've worsened my epistemic position considerably.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. It really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
So the other model is by Jennifer Lackey. And she says, look, you have to take experts as advisors, you know, but like a coach, like a personal trainer. The personal trainer obviously is no better than I how to get fit in a short amount of time. But, you know, there could be various other reasons or overriding reasons. Suppose that they say, okay, you should really start training for a marathon. And I think, I just don't like running. You should be able to override the expert. And I think that this is an improvement over the Zagzebski position. But the problem is that I think our epistemic duties are not just to ourselves, but have a sort of broader societal level impact. Like if I am somebody who entertains a lot of pseudoscientific beliefs, it's not just going to impact me, but potentially sort of deteriorates the epistemic climate. So that's why I think it's not as easy as to say, oh, I'm going to follow the advisor or not. And that you should actually give the expert a bit more weight. And I thought that the teacher-student relation is something that helps to capture that. And in fact, if you look at the way people talk traditionally about religious experts, they very often use the language of teacher, like rabbi is a teacher, for example. And I think that is probably right. Like, you know, obviously you're not going to, if your teacher starts doing really weird things, it's totally fine to, you know, maybe notify the police or whatever. But you still give a teacher more weight and respect. And respect sounds like, and deference are sort of things that aren't really part of our, you know, like the university of life and in general our discourse. But I think respect and deference definitely have some role to play in our epistemic lives. And, you know, if somebody spend a lot of time figuring out these issues about epidemiology and does their best to apply that to the current situation, and I think I'm going to see this person as somebody who helps teaches me, and ideally this is somebody with good public science abilities, you know, you have a few people like that on Twitter, then, you know, I should take it seriously, just like you wouldn't just cast aside what a teacher says without any strong other reasons. So that's roughly the model that I defend in the book and that I think works very well for religious disagreement and for adjudicating what experts are saying.
You also mention in the book about how the intuitions of philosophers in a variety of fields tend to mirror positions of the population in general. And so that brings up this challenging question of, is there really such a thing as philosophical expertise?
It's a very hard question. So in the early days of experimental philosophy, it was revealed that intuitions that experimental philosophers said every adult would see this sort of idea. Like, for example, here's a very early example. In order for you to be free, to have free will, it can't be the case that all your actions have been determined up until this point. So the idea of compatibilism is actually not something that the folk hold. It's an idea proposed by libertarians about free will. But then you had experimental philosophy, philosophers like, I think, Eddie Nemias, who actually tested this. So they gave people the following story. You have this guy. And imagine that the universe is completely deterministic and, you know, you have the Big Bang and everything just like everything that happens is because of a previous physical cause. And so then you have Jones or whatever, the philosophical stock character. And there he is in 2022 and he robs a bank. Now, did he do this out of his own free will or didn't he? And it turned out that many people, in fact, thought that he did because he there wasn't somebody holding a gun to his head about, you know, go and rob the bank, even though you have this long causal chain. But then, so the question was, okay, if philosophers, philosophical intuitions, we do have a lot of the intuitions that we use in philosophy, like, for example, that are underlying Gettier cases. So this is research by Edouard Machery. It turns out that the Gettier cases is a sort of thing. So just to briefly for the audience. So suppose I look at my clock, at my watch, and it's 2 p.m. And I form the belief it's 2 p.m. and my watch has never, ever broken down. So, you know, I have good reasons to believe that it's 2 p.m. But in fact, my watch did break down exactly 24 hours ago. So, or 12 hours ago, it's 12-hour clock. And so I have a justified true belief, but it seems like I do not know that it's 2 o'clock right now, because it could have been different. Like, I have a case of good luck and a case of bad luck because my watch broke down. Good luck because I happened to look exactly 12 hours after it broke down. And it turns out, so is this knowledge, me knowing, do I know it's 2 o'clock? Well, it turns out people across cultures, they say, you don't know that. So this is really interesting. It's something that across cultures, it seems like we have these Gettier intuitions because it's called a Gettier case. So the question is then, what is it for philosophers? Like, do they have any sort of special insights? So you have this whole debate about special insights of philosophers. Mm-hmm. And Edouard Machery, in fact, has argued that philosophers don't have any special insights and that our intuitions are not more reliable than those of other people. And in fact, other people are just our peers as with regard to. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, there are certain things, certain examples and ideas that lay people would just not think about, or, you know, so in a sense, take, for example, William Rowe's Fawn in the Forest, his story about, suppose that you say, okay, an all good and all knowing God was all powerful, would prevent needless suffering. Now imagine you have a fawn and it's trapped in a forest fire, and this is very actual because of all the forest fires, and it just stuck and it's slowly suffocating. God could have ended that fawn's life, or, you know, could have given it a way out. There is nothing gained by this fawn being in this situation. And so, you know, an atheist can, at least on evidential grounds, say God doesn't exist, the God as construed, you know, in this way. Now Rowe's argument is very subtle in that respect, but I'm thinking that this sort of examples, this sort of thought experiments, and the way that they help us think about questions, I think that is really something philosophers can really do, sort of like thinking about unusual situations or drawing unusual consequences out of things we do every day. It's something you get trained for. So this is what I think that philosophy is. So it's basically, it's born in a sense of wonder. So I have this Plato idea that, you know, philosophy is born in wonder, and we systematize and we build, we argue. And it's true that our raw intuitions are probably not more reliable than that of other people, but we still have this practice of taking these sorts of everyday things and transforming them and mulling over them and doing things with them that I think without a philosophical training, you wouldn't come up with.
If I'm an individual looking for help on religious questions, whether it's the big, does God or gods exist or other ones, how common do you think it is for people to turn to theologians or philosophers for expertise versus, say, their family members, their friends who are practicing a particular religious faith or tradition? How common is it to turn to those experts that I was just identifying, do you think?
I think it is more common than we tend to give ourselves credit as philosophers. There is actually also empirical research on this. So I've read papers on deconversion. So you probably know that in the United States, Christianity is decreasing at a very, very rapid pace. Like so rapidly, like the Pew Center was surprised at how. And this is going to have huge effects in all sorts of ways. Like, our societies will not be the same because of that. And the question is, why do people do that? Lots of research has gone into that, and it's very interesting to see people's responses. So some people just disengage, like they sort of think, yeah, maybe there's a God. But the problem is that God isn't doing anything for them. It's not playing a meaningful role in their overall life projects. But at the same time, people are then wondering, like, what sort of reasons do I have for belief? So it's interesting for us to try to disentangle or to try to get a better grip on the pragmatic ideas that people have, but also the sorts of real, like, people want to have true beliefs. They don't want to have false beliefs in general, or they want to have fewer false beliefs. And I know these two things are not the same, right? So we have this variety of epistemic aims. Like, we genuinely do want the truth. And I think that even a young Earth creationist doesn't want to be misled. Like, they just hope that overall their worldview is the correct worldview. And what I see in deconversion narratives is that people just tune out because they have this package deal and they don't like the package deal. Like, okay, if I have to be a Christian, it means that I have to be anti-LGBTQ, or it has to be that I have to be anti-abortion, or that I have to reject science. And I found it so surprising in those narratives how often that came up. You know, you have to choose between science or religion, and you know, you don't have to set it up that way. So it's actually, I blame American Christians for making it this way, because if you look throughout the history of Christianity, generally, this is a supportive relationship, you know, things like Galileo notwithstanding. But there is this sort of dichotomy being set up. And, you know, if you force people to choose between science and religion, then sometimes, because people are concerned for truth, they will choose science. And I don't know, like, so there are some podcasts like the Veritas Forum that, you know, religious people will often cite, like, I want to listen to that and just see the arguments and see how well can you make the case. I've heard this of people, like, including students that I taught. How well can you make the case for the God of classical theism? I want to see how well can you make that case. And if you can't make a convincing case, well, then I'm just off and I'll do something else.
I want to bring up a big picture rounding out question. We, as you mentioned, religion's on the decline in the United States. It's been, even before that in Europe, even more on the decline, at least in Western Europe, especially Christianity. What benefits do you see from religion, generally speaking, as well as what concerns might you have on a societal level with the decline of religion in the United States?
So I think that religion in general, and this is just very generally speaking, so I read two books that I want to mention here that I think are very accessible and give a good idea about why are people religious. One book is called The Need, I think it is called The Need for Religion by Stephen Asma. And the other one is The Joy of Religion by Ariel Glücklich. So both of those authors actually argue that in order to understand why people engage in religion is that it helps them to manage their emotions. So life throws you all sorts of curveballs, and it's very hard to deal with that. And I don't mean that in a sort of sense that religion is just there to sort of put us asleep and think about, oh yeah, it's all going to be okay. Like, things are terrible now, but the hereafter, here I come. Like, that doesn't help you now, right? It doesn't help you that much now. But it does help you to give meaning to things. And it helps you to manage your emotions as well. So religious festivals, and this is why, another reason why COVID is so terrible, religious festivals and gatherings and personal religious rituals help you to manage your emotions and expectations and help you to deal with those curveballs and also to deal, you know, with the good things. And it sort of gives you that extra stuff that helps to make human lives worthwhile. So I think that religion is very crucial to human flourishing. I'm not saying that people who are atheists don't have flourishing. They have lots of other ways to do it. But religions offer this sort of way to take. You just, you know, you put it on almost like ready-made clothes that you can sort of tailor a bit to yourself. And that can help you to navigate, you know, the difficulty of life. Like, it's just hard to live our lives. And I think if Christianity is on the decline like this, it's very clear, talking to my students and just also in general, that people are not turning into naturalists. Like, my students love astrology. Like, this is just the thing. Like, it seems like Zoomers and millennials love astrology. And I think this helps them to give meaning to things. So we will have new, if Christianity can't regain a foothold in the US. And I think, in fact, that the events the past few years will further spell an end to Christianity. I don't know, like, I don't know what the future holds, but it'd be extremely difficult for churches to turn this around. But if that happens, then people will fill this void with some other religious practices, I think, inevitably.
I think so. I'm always looking for the different ways in which religion manifests for people. And I tend to take a very broad conception of religion. And I do see that manifest in lots of my friends who've deconverted, that religious life manifests oftentimes for some of them in semi-political causes, or maybe it could be astrology, but there's things that they're reaching for. Call it the religious impulse, but it seems to be there for most of us in some way, or even approaching science in a scientistic sort of pseudo-religious way. There's just something there for most of us that we try and find to guide us religiously.
Definitely, yes, yes.
Helen, I appreciate you coming on the show. You recommended a bunch of great books at the end there, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you. It was great.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.